morning. It is great to see all of you. I'm Dr. Amanda Pittman. I'll be one of your hosts for today's Pathway. I want to take just a minute to welcome you to this first session, 9:45. You will occasionally hear me give some brief text that tells you something you already know, like that we're in room 128 and that it's 9 o'clock in the morning. That's for the purpose of the recording of this session. So all of these sessions are recorded because Summit serves both the audience that is here and the audience that is spread across the country. So this is, you will hear at the beginning of every session us state the time and the date and the place, and we know you know that, but it's so the people taking the recordings also know that information too. Much of the conversation in American Christianity over the last few years keeps coming back to the question of young adults or emerging adults, right? People who are on the cusp of beginning their adult lives. And sometimes this conversation sort of generates more heat than light, right? Sometimes there's a lot of anxiety and we wanted, and a lot of hope. And we wanted to spend some time thinking together with you about what we know about emerging adult Christianity and emerging adult faith. So here's what the flow of the day is going to look like. First, this first session is called Fresh Takes on College Freshmen. We're going to be talking about some research we've been doing with college freshmen over the last couple of years. And we're going to look at some specific features of their life of faith. In the next session, we have Dr. Susie Macaluzzo and Dr. Lynette Sharp-Pena, who are going to be talking about the factors associated with young adults who choose to leave faith, right, or to disaffiliate from Christianity. In the session after lunch, we're going to spend some time hearing from people who are actively engaged in ministry with young adults. So we'll have a roundtable discussion with people currently working with young adult populations. And then our very last session today, we're joining forces with the racial justice session at Summit this year for a panel of students who are going to be talking about their experience at the intersection of race and spiritual formation. And given our current climate, we believe that's one of the really important conversations that's going to be happening at Summit this year. If you're just coming in, welcome. I'm Dr. Amanda Pittman. This is Dr. John Boyles, and this will be the Faith in Emerging Adulthood Pathway. Welcome to Summit.
So, we're college professors. Let's see a couple of folks that know us. So we thought it would be really fun to start with a pop quiz. How's that sound? All right, so we invite you, pull out your smartphone, or if you have a computer or something. If you don't, we have a couple on hand we can help you with. But we've given you a URL up here. If you'll just pull up your browser, Safari on an iPhone, or whatever browser you like to use, and type in this URL, https://www.surveymonkey.com/r, and then /ACU, and then capitalized Bible. And this will take you to a set of questions that are about biblical content. And we invite you, just go with your first instinct. If your first instinct is, I don't know, there's an option for that.
All right, so over the last decade or so, there have been several books published about young adults and faith, or religious belief in general, right? So they like Jesus, but not the church, is one example. Some publications out of the Barna Group, and often we have a lot of talking about young adults, but we need more opportunities to hear from young adults. And so for the last 2 years, that's exactly what we've been trying to do, right? If you're a member of, if you're a millennial, which I am, just barely, or a member of Generation Z, right, you might feel this. Like, you hear people talk about your life or your faith in particular kinds of ways. Well, we wanted to look at specifically at a subset of people who opted into Christian college. And so we've spent the last 2 years gathering data about the spiritual lives of first-year college students at this Christian college. Right? We wanted to gather some information about the shape of your spiritual lives, about the kind of Christian practices that are important to you, about what you know and believe about the Bible, about your sense of connection with God. And so we want to reflect on that a little bit together this morning. But we want to do it in this way, right? Sometimes when we're talking about a group, and I'll talk for a second to the people who are not part of Generation Z or are millennial, sometimes when we're talking about another group, we tend to sort of look at them from a distance as if there's like a distant specimen sort of over there, right? And sometimes in our current climate, our way of talking about generational differences works this way, right? There are those people over there, and then there's me. We want to try to resist that a little bit this morning. And we're going to share some of our findings from our research, but we want to do it in a way that prompts you to think about your own spiritual life. right? Rather than simply examining someone who's over there, I wanted to see what questions it raises for us about our own spiritual formation and also about our responsibilities together as congregations and as the body of Christ. So that's the angle we're going to take into our conversation this morning. All right, before we look at these, we've got the results of the survey we just did together. But before we look at that, I want to do a little polling. Right? How many of you would say that you think among this group that we got at least 50% of the questions right? Raise your hand nice and high if you think, yeah, we probably got 50% of the questions correct. Okay, keep them up if you still think 60, 70, 80. All right, let's do the same poll, but for, so most hands were down at 80%. Let's do the same poll for like a group of 18-year-olds. Right? We're talking hundreds and hundreds of 18-year-olds. All right, so 50%, same poll, interesting. Okay, 40%, see if a few more, let's go the other way. See if a few more hands go up. 30%, all right. So let's do a little bit of comparison.
So, here is the graph for our class, right here. We notice a few things, right? There are particular spikes at the 41 to 50% range, the 71 to 80% range, and the 91 to 100% range. And you can see there on the top, the average is 71%, or 15 out of the 21 questions answered correctly. And we have a couple down here. We've got some folks who got 100%, right? Some of those folks. We've got a low score of 29%, which is around like six or seven questions correct. And then a median score, meaning the exact middle of all of us, if we lined our scores up on a chart, at 79%. So y'all are pretty good at predicting for yourselves. As you think about that, what kinds of things maybe strike you, or if you think about the questions, are there questions that you think might have been more difficult for this group? What do you think?
I'm going to guess Old Testament questions were probably harder than the New Testament questions.
Okay.
Yeah. See a few heads nodding around the room. That may have been the case for you.
Other thoughts?
For me, it was like chronologically. Like, I have heard the stories before, but sometimes I forget, like, in what order they came in. Some of the questions were on that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Or which prophet was which?
Oh, yeah.
Which prophet was that one, right? Yeah. Yes. Any other thoughts as you observe this graph or think about the questions? So let's take a look at the distribution for college freshmen, and then we'll ask for if there are any reactions you have there as well. So this is from fall of 2017, and this is the distribution for almost all of the freshmen who entered our university at that time. What do you notice, or what do you find surprising or wonder about?
So for those of us who didn't see the survey questions, I don't know what you're talking about.
Okay, so we weren't able to access it. So we had a
government cell phone, it wouldn't let
it. It wouldn't. So we asked 21 questions, and they're a variety of kinds. Some of them are Old Testament questions, some are New Testament questions, some are, as was mentioned, chronologically based questions. So in this set of events, four events, which one happened first, or which person came late, and some were genre questions. If you wanted to read, for example, poetry, which of these books would you read? Things like this, the set of 21 questions. Thank you for that.
Yeah. So I find it interesting that it, right after 60%, it drops off and bumps back up again at 70%. So I'm betting those are the homeschool kids.
Some of the questions were a little detailed that you needed to think about. After I hit one, I was like, oh, that's right, he wasn't the second king, he was the third, you know, whatever. You know, you're just thinking back, oh, yeah, I forgot to count him or whatever. So, you know, the context in which you're taking it, mm-hmm. are you doing it quickly, are you taking mm-hmm. a lot of time to be exact?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Some do ask a lot of questions.
Mm-hmm. Right, and for the purpose of this graph, it did code, I don't know, as an incorrect answer, but there's wisdom in at least recognizing you don't know, mm-hmm. right?
What was the sample size of students that this was conducted by?
So this is 927 students. When you think about the questions, let's do a little bit of more fun. What do you think was the hardest question for you to answer?
Hmm.
those of you who are able to look at them. But the one that is most likely to be missed in this group.
I did not know what happened at the end of Revelation.
Okay.
And I have looked at this data. I have a slight advantage. I still couldn't remember what the right
still
answer
is. Still don't know.
That's one of those books we don't always read a lot of for a variety of reasons.
What about the college freshmen as you think about the questions? Which one do you think would be hardest for them? Yeah.
I would say probably the one about which of the prophets did God ask to marry a prostitute?
Okay.
There's a bunch of minor prophets. I was like, I don't remember any of these.
I don't remember which one that is. Yeah.
I think a question like, what was the tone of the book of Galatians? I don't think that's the kind of thing that's covered in a Bible bowl, you know.
Yeah. These are good candidates, both of these. They were high on the list. But the one that was most missed is which one of these is not one of the 12 apostles?
Really?
Yes. Because a lot of us feel like Mark must be an apostle. Right? I see some reactions. Mark's not an apostle, even though there's a gospel named after him.
So this is one rough and ready measure of biblical content knowledge. All right? This is not a perfect quiz. It's not the end-all be-all of Bible knowledge quizzes. It is trying to get something of a sense of the breadth of our knowledge. Right? Old Testament, New Testament, order of events, what kinds of books are like, which is what the tone of Galatians is trying to get at. But the question that it raises and that we like to pose for this group is, what difference does any of this make? Right? Does it matter in the life of faith that you know which one of those biblical events comes earlier? And if so, how does it matter? Does it make a difference that you know that Abraham was the first name mentioned, or that it was Peter in Acts 10 who saw that vision of the sheep descending with the clean and unclean animals on it? As a tradition among churches of Christ, we've long prided ourselves on being people of the book. And that's a commitment that I share. But I wonder sometimes if we haven't paused often enough to articulate why we think it's valuable to know the content of the Bible in the way at least churches of Christ and many other denominations really prize. And so I'm going to toss that question out to you. Why is it important to your spiritual life that you know the content of the Bible?
So we're able to give an answer if someone asks us the reason we have for our hope or our beliefs and our faith.
Right. 1 Peter 3. Right. To be prepared to give a reason for the hope that we have. Yeah.
I think it helps improve our theological reflection that is based on something that's in the Bible rather than just guesses or it's kind of founded on something that's solid. So it's not the end all, but it's like a good first step to get somewhere else where I'm going to think about things with good theology and come out with good action as a result of that.
Right. So to understand a claim like God is love, a foundational theological claim, the content of that claim is God's action toward his creation. Right, as reflected in the scriptures. So we have claims, but that gives substance to some of those. All right, thanks.
I think knowing those like random facts, like who did this or like when did this happen, just shows how much you know the Bible. And we really, what they were saying was, we really do need to know the Bible. So asking those type of questions shows like how much you've really poured your life or studied the Bible, essentially, and how important it is.
Right, great. I love that. So maybe it's not just that you happen to know Abraham was first, but that the fact that you know that it's Abraham or Peter or Ruth or whoever else is indicative of the time that you've spent actually deeply engaging in the story. Right? So not so much the fact, but what the fact reflects. I like that. Someone else, why does it matter to you in your own spiritual life to know the content of the Bible?
Please.
Yeah.
The Bible's how we get to know God. So the deeper we understand the Bible, the deeper we're able to love God.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it's the way you're framing it, Bible knowledge isn't an end unto itself, right? It's aiming at something beyond that, right? At the knowledge of the God the Bible reveals. Thanks. I wonder if you think about your own spiritual life, what are the figures or the opportunities in your life that have shaped what you know and understand about the Bible? What are the the experiences that you've had or the relationships that you've had that have shaped how you understand the Bible and what you know about it?
I spent time in post-Christian Germany and saw the types of theology that was being perpetrated and the types of theological education there, so that impacted me deeply.
And can you say a little bit more about the kind of impact that it had?
Well, basically, I saw that there wasn't a lot of trust in the Word as being God's Word, and so then the impact of that is then you can just make a lot of decisions on your own without looking back to an authority.
And so perhaps thinking through the consequences of not having. All right, thank you very much. Someone else, or an experience or a relationship or a context even that really shaped how you came to know and understand the Bible?
I grew up in a Christian home, went to church three times a week, but my parents weren't in the Word a lot on their own or anything like that. A lot of us struggled with that. But when I got married, my wife's parents were so in the Word constantly, and it just flowed from them constantly. It just my mother-in-law just passed away this past year, but one of the things that people talked about was exactly that. Word was so immersed in their lives that it was just part of their constant daily speech. Mm-hmm. So it really made the Word alive to me. See it in their lives and in their speech. Yeah.
So it shaped even the way that they talked about things.
Oh, yeah.
And
absolutely.
The way they interpreted things.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. So the function of the role of a model.
Yeah.
Or an exemplar. Someone who you aspire to be like in some aspect of your faith. Thank you. And the reflection or two, what has shaped the way you have come to know and understand the Bible?
I received two different methodologies at church. One was Sunday school, where great storytelling went on, and so you got the narrative dimensions to the stories, and it may have been with a flannel graph or whatever, but you got the story. But then you went to the sermon or the other parts of church life, and it was simply a series of fragments. It was little proof text points that you used to argue with someone on a theological point.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like two different methodologies in tension.
Uh-huh. You have a preference for one of those?
Definitely. I teach literature. I love story. Let's go for narrative.
Yeah. Well, and we already named that as one of the things that's difficult about answering the questions in order, is you can know a lot about the Bible individually in terms of individual stories or characters, but not have very much of a sense of the overall. Now, I saw another hand over here. Yes, thank you.
Well, I grew up in a little different era back east, where the churches were very small, and our church that we went to was very small. And so in school, you were very much the minority. The popular kids were Methodists and Presbyterians and so forth. And I think the fact that we studied the Bible helped give us confidence that we were okay, even though we weren't among the popular group. It helped us encourage us in our faith and retain the faith, because you kind of had that pressure, and anytime you feel pressure against you, you tend to want to react the other way. And studying the Bible gives you something concrete that helps you push back against that influence.
And what I hear you naming too is the Bible and its role not just in our own spiritual journeys, but in the life of a community of faith.
Yes.
Right? Our Bible reading, even when we read by ourselves, is always influenced by the ways we learn to read from other communities.
And those other kids didn't know the Bible.
Thanks. I'm going to shift and think about another. Biblical knowledge is one element that we looked at. We're going to shift and look at a bit of a different one now.
We want to think some with y'all again in this theme of not just looking at a generation or a group of people as outsiders or as alien to them and saying things about them, but inviting us to think about some things about ourselves in the same mode. And so what we're handing out to you now is a set of practices. And we invite you, hopefully we have enough copies, but we invite you to go ahead and rate your own frequency of practice on the sheet, from never, something that you never do, up to things that you do more regularly. Okay? And then we'll unpack some of this together. As you finish, we invite you to go ahead and turn your sheet over. Maybe do some reflection on the back. As you think about your responses on the front, are there things that encourage you? Are there perhaps things that convict you when it comes to your own spiritual practices? And perhaps where might God be calling you into deeper or broader, perhaps even more sustained practices in various areas?
First question was, what encourages you and what was that?
Is there something that might encourage you or something that might convict you or make you feel like, oh, I didn't realize that maybe I wasn't doing that as frequently as I wished, or maybe I wasn't doing a lot of these?
Yeah. All right, we're going to do the same comparison with this that we did with the previous one. So what you're going to see on the slide in just a moment are a series of numbers, a series of averages next to some different practices. So let me briefly explain how that works. So an average of 1 is an average of never, all right, because 1 equals never. So an average of 5 is something that you would do every single day, right? So the averages up here are going to be averages 1 out of 5, right? What this lets you do is sort of look at where you circled on the number you circled on any given one and see how it compares to the average on the screen. This is from that same population of students, so we're talking about a very large group, again, of entering freshmen at ACU, right? So take a second, look at these averages, and compare them to your own. Do that first. All right, then I wonder what you notice as of any observations you have about these averages compared to either your own or where you might have expected them to be.
I would say they're more similar to my own than I expected. And in terms like within maybe 1 point on most of them. I think the one that surprises me the most is the lower number for the Bible reading, considering that they're in Bible class. And maybe the connection between that and worship services.
Mm-hmm. So the original question on the survey did specify it had to be Bible reading outside of class.
Okay.
Right, because we know whether or not every student every time is doing the reading that's assigned, we know there is assigned reading. So we wanted to bracket that off. So this is elective Bible reading,
okay,
which would explain why the number is not, you know, several times a week, right, or about once a day.
Interesting.
Yes, yeah, so this is Bible reading on your own time, not part of a worship service, not part of a Bible class.
Okay. That just suddenly reframes the number, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I have to say I'm really happy that so many other freshmen are, like, listening to quite the Christian music.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it, like, helps you stay in a certain good frame of mind sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just cool.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious for for folks in the room who are not the age of current undergraduate students, would this be a practice that you would have thought to list on, like, a survey of Christian practices?
Listening to Christian music, that is.
I would not have thought to list it, but I listen to it every day while driving. But I still would have thought to ask someone else that question.
Now, I think what you're pointing at it puts you in a certain frame of mind, which is to say it's formative.
Yeah.
Right? It has the capacity to shape your imagination, the things that occur to you when you're doing something else. Right? And for many of us, hymns serve this function also. Right? There are moments in my life when the first thing that comes to me, if it isn't scripture, it's probably an old hymn that I know, right, that sort of lives deep in my bones. Well, we know music has that kind of formative power, and in addition to singing, for many people that I know, listening to Christian music is part of that too. Good. Other observations or reactions?
I think fasting is pretty high for a freshman. Like, I don't think many freshmen understand fasting, and I just feel like that's a higher number.
Yeah. I mean, I was prepared for that one to be a lot closer to never.
Mm-hmm.
All right, but that's actually a fair amount of fasting, I think. And one of the curious things, so we gave the survey at the beginning of the year and at the end of the year. And at the end of the year, more of the first-year students had practiced fasting than at the beginning. All right, and we wondered maybe if that's because that's a Christian practice that maybe hadn't been part of your church experience up to that point. What was something you got introduced to on a college campus surrounded by Christians from lots of different backgrounds and hearing from different Christian professors and reading the Sermon on the Mount in a way that maybe you hadn't read it before? Good. Other reactions as you think about either how these compare to what you might have imagined or how they compare to your own scores? Yeah.
I'm within a half point of every one of those except for small group. Because I just don't do small groups. But otherwise, I'm like a college freshman. Believe it or not.
Now we had a very similar reaction, right? And so again, one of our tendencies, especially when we're talking across sort of generational divides, is to think of other people as being very different than ourselves. But actually, that's not really how that's not the story this data, at least, is telling us. Right? That we actually have far more in common in communities of faith in terms of the practices that are important to us, the things we actually do, than we do differences. Right? Those differences might tend to show up more, we could imagine, among older adults and younger adults when it comes to Bible knowledge. But can we honestly say, like, older adults also have an advantage in that they've had longer to read? Right? There are other reasons why an older adult might have more Bible knowledge at their disposal. Well, they've been at this for longer. Right? So that sometimes that's just an indication of time and not an indication of a lack of caring.
So we'd like to spend the remainder of our time together thinking about the implications of these two pieces. There is much more data we could throw at you, which could be super fun, right? Lots of numbers. But these two pieces, they connect well. Because we might look at those averages on Bible content knowledge and think, wow, that's low. But when we think about college freshmen and we think about them entering this particular environment, I'd like to frame that in terms of, wow, what an opportunity. And when we think about this elective Bible reading that we've already talked about, wow, what an opportunity for thinking about that. And also, when we ask you, right, what has come to be a value for you when it comes to Bible content knowledge, we got some responses where folks were naming some pretty valuable things. And so, how can we help young adults, emerging adults, know some of those things? What opportunities are there for us in those terms? So let's start here on this front. What kinds of opportunities does this perhaps make you think about with spiritual formation ministries or encouraging practices or helping students learn the Bible in your own ministries?
It makes me think that we need to maybe broaden the spiritual formation practices that we're encouraging. You know, like a lot of us said, listening to Christian music isn't something we thought about, but maybe that's something that we should be encouraging, along with kind of more of the things that we traditionally think of in terms of like prayer and attendance at things, but also maybe teaching young adults about fasting and the importance of that, as well as other spiritual disciplines like silence and solitude.
Yeah, and I might suggest also when we think about music, right, when I walk around campus and see folks around campus, and I'm not going to say whether these are students or not, because there are lots of people that aren't students on our campus, but I see a lot of people with headphones in all the time. And I see a lot of people in the gym with headphones in all the time. And maybe this thinking about the power of Christian music in terms of how it shapes us or how it changes our mood, maybe that's also an invitation for us to think about what it is that we're listening to regularly. Whether that's music or podcasts, what is it that we're filling ourselves with, that we're exposing ourselves with on a regular basis? And you may have noticed that we didn't have up here, but you had on your sheet, the practice of silence and solitude. What is it that we're not exposing ourselves to when we don't pause and listen and sit? That was another hand. Opportunities.
Oh, I think I might raise my hand. I'm one of the older guys in our church. And it seems like there's an opportunity for me to interact with younger people and learn from them and see what's valuable to them and vice versa. And we might have some different things that we focus on and could help each other.
Intergenerational connections. This is really powerful. And at the end, we'll give you a couple of data-driven claims about how this is so powerful, these intergenerational connections.
So I'm thinking about like your question on silence and solitude, and I'm wondering about if you explored other language like meditation or mindfulness. You know, some things, a phrase becomes kind of chic, if you will, and mindfulness is one of those. The Navy is exploring mindfulness, whereas in the past it would have been equated with a spiritual discipline. But in institutional settings, you have these things that are in vogue now. And mindfulness is a tool of resiliency training. And there's part of that that troubles me because the definition of mindfulness and so forth is so nebulous, and this idea of being present, which, you know, we can spend a lot of time on that. You can't help, you live in the present. You know, there's aspects of that that are just unavoidable. And being, and it's almost like we celebrate being present rather than speaking in just being self-aware or being aware of the needs of others, you know, something like that. But the phrase itself becomes something we kind of begin to honor, like, I'm mindful, or I'm present. And we have kind of a cottage industry that's sprung up with that. And I'm wondering how that equates to, I mean, in some sense, should we go ahead into that in our ministries? Should we be more discerning about it? I don't know. My constituents are millennials and centennials, depending on what phrase you use, but the largest recruiting block for the Navy will soon be people born from 97 to 2012. Mm-hmm. And 75% of the Navy is millennials and centennials.
Yeah, I suspect, given especially the framing that you're bringing, and our students who are in the room may remember this, but all of our students are required to take a course called Cornerstone in their first semester. And depending on which year they took it, there's a talk that Dr. Richard Beck does titled Mindfulness. And I think this is an invitation into what you're saying, because one of the things that Dr. Beck is doing is setting the stage for what does that mean. And I think in ministry, if we bring in that language, the opportunity we have is to structure it in terms of how is this Christian spiritual formation? And silence and solitude are a little bit more ancient in terms of their language. I suspect that if we asked at the end of the year and we had included mindfulness, that given that talk from Dr. Beck, the number may have jumped up a little bit just because of that language connection. But I think in our context, the opportunity to define that and to say, what does this look like in a Christian context, and what do we do in a Christian way? And I like what you said about considering our own needs, considering the needs of others, being aware of those things. In our language, we were specifically thinking about and inviting the participants and y'all to think about connecting with God in this silence or solitude. And this, to some extent, is something Randy Harris talks about regularly on our campus as well, the idea that if we just spend time waiting for God, maybe God doesn't answer for a while, but the practice of inviting God to speak into our lives does something to us, and one day, God may speak to us. Any thoughts, opportunities in our ministries?
Well, thinking about an experience that we had with some high school students this past year where we asked them about some of their spiritual practices, and one of the things that came up was that they really struggled with prayer and knowing how to pray. And it was a really interesting opportunity to maybe think and reflect on, well, how were we taught to pray? What are some different ways to pray? How could you get started when you don't know what to say, but you want to pray? And so taking a moment to kind of check in with maybe if you have kids at home or students or ministries that you work with, and finding out where they're at with some of these things. And then just kind of taking a moment, drawing on some different people's knowledge and experience to say, well, here are some different opportunities to learn how to pray, or to try to make this something that is interesting and available and accessible to you. And so we kind of talked about some different structures of ways that you could pray, using a passage, using from scripture, using a more scripted prayer, using starting with words of thanks, you know, kind of all these different opportunities. And I think it was really meaningful to them, and they were really interested in it.
And that's an interesting way of thinking about it, because it's pairing an ought, right, it's something you should do, with a how, and attending to the obstacles to that. I think there's a lot of wisdom in saying, what are the things that you feel like keep you from praying? Right? If it's not knowing where to start, there's 2,000 years of Christian ideas about how to do that, but making those available and accessible.
And I think, too, this connects well with our opening talk last night from Mike Cope about the Psalms as the church's prayer book.
Yeah.
Opportunities to think about how those prayers can become our own. And Mike's suggestion to all of us that we invite ourselves into that engagement, reading the Psalms, praying through the Psalms, reading them as prayer. And I think also this statement about thinking about how did we learn these things? Right? How were we formed to practice the things that we were formed? When I think about myself, how was I formed in that way? Well, it was just because that was what we did in my family. Right? We went to church every Sunday. We went to midweek service on Wednesdays. We prayed every time I went to bed. Right? We read the Bible. We had family devotionals. How did I learn? Well, we did it. And at some point in my life, I needed some help understanding why and what it was doing. And I think our youth are just like us. They need some help understanding, what is this for? What does this do? How does it work? And I think the way that we've been able to discuss this today opens up the opportunities for us for some things. And I maybe will throw some surprising facts out there for you. So when we look at our data, there's another question that we asked, another set of questions that have to do with students' connections, the way they feel connected to God, and also the way they feel connected to a community of faith. And one of those, we asked them to respond from strongly disagree to strongly agree. So five options are strongly disagree, neutral, agree, and strongly agree about whether or not an older adult has helped them in their spiritual life. And I think we were surprised to find that when we look at the variation on those practices, when we combine them all and look at the overall averages, that variation, 22% of it, which is pretty solid amount, given all the various factors that go into all of our lives, 22% of that variation can be explained by whether or not an older adult helped these young people in their spiritual journey. That's powerful. When we look at the Bible content knowledge, 13% of the variation in those answers could be explained by whether or not an older adult had helped these young people in their spiritual lives. So we suggest to you that there's much we have in common, but also much we can do to connect to one another and to help one another and journey with one another. Final words?
Yeah, so we spent this session talking about young adults who've stayed, right? People who've committed to come to a Christian college, who are pursuing a life of faith. In the next section, we're going to switch and talk about folks who have left.